This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. Two U.S. officials say after 20 years, the U.S. military left Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, the epicenter of its war, to oust the Taliban and hunt down the al-Qaeda perpetrators of the 9/11 terrorist attacks here in the U.S. The airfield was reportedly handed over to the Afghan National Security Defense Force in its entirety. The withdrawal is the clearest indication that the last of the 2,500 to 3,500 U.S. troops have left Afghanistan or are nearing a departure, months ahead of President Joe Biden's promise that they would be gone by September the 11th. The U.S. will also have about 6,500 troops in Afghanistan to protect its sprawling embassy in the capital. Most NATO soldiers have already quietly exited as of this week. Search and rescue efforts resumed Thursday evening at the partially collapsed Florida condominium building, where at least 18 people were killed and 145 are still missing. The rescue operations unfolded on the same day that President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden visited the devastated community, meeting privately with families and first responders before visiting a memorial near the site of the tragedy in Surfside, Florida. Biden announced that the Federal Emergency Management Agency will provide temporary housing and other urgent needs for those made homeless by the disaster. Hundreds of search and rescue personnel have painstakingly searched the rubble for potential signs of life, but no one has been rescued since the first hours after the collapse last Thursday. For more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com. Also on the VOA mobile app, via remote, this is VOA News. The Boy Scouts of America has reached an agreement with attorneys representing some 60,000 victims of child sex abuse in what could prove to be a pivotal moment in the organization's bankruptcy case. Attorneys for the BSA filed court papers late Thursday outlining a restructuring support agreement with attorneys representing abuse victims. The BSA sought bankruptcy protection last year, moving to halt lawsuits and create a compensation fund for men who were molested as youngsters decades ago. Prosecutors in New York on Thursday issued an indictment charging the Trump Organization, the company owned by former President Donald Trump, with operating a 15-year scheme to defraud the government, alleging that the organization compensated senior executives with off-the-books benefits such as cash, private school tuition, and luxury cars without reporting it to the IRS or state tax authorities as income. At the same time, prosecutors indicted the company's 73-year-old chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, on 15 charges, including grand larceny and tax fraud. Both Weisselberg and the Trump Organization have pleaded not guilty and vowed to fight the charges in court. The Justice Department is halting federal executions after a historic use of capital punishment by the Trump administration, which carried out 13 executions in a six-month period. Attorney General Merrick Garland says he is imposing a moratorium on federal executions while the Justice Department conducts a review of its policies and procedures. Donald Trump's Justice Department resumed federal executions in July following a 17-year hiatus. No president in more than 120 years had overseen as many federal executions. President Biden has said he opposes the death penalty, and his team vowed that he would take action to stop its use while in office. In other news, officials say at least 9 civilians, including a number of women, have been killed in an attack by rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The attack in the eastern city Beni is the third in the area this week. Police and the military have blamed allied Democratic Forces rebels for the violence. The U.S. ambassador to Congo, Mike Hammer, visited Beni Thursday, pledging solidarity with the residents, and he said the U.S. would help track down the attackers. For more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Today is Friday, July the 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. UN aid agencies are warning of a looming humanitarian catastrophe in Ethiopia's Tigray region if they are prevented from delivering life-saving assistance to the area.
Major towns, including Mekelle, Adigrat, Adwa.
Eric Aneko, spokesperson for the UN Secretary General. In Tanzania, opposition leaders and rights activists are calling on the government to revise the constitution to allow for more political space. And Burundi and Rwanda have promised to normalize relations after more than 6 years of tensions between the two neighboring countries.
It follows the several meetings that have been held since 2020 between the two countries, one between the military and another between the ministers of foreign affairs at Nemba, one-stop border post.
In Zambia, the ruling Patriotic Front, PF, is accusing the main opposition United Party for National Development Alliance of violating a directive banning campaigning in parts of the country. Plus, the battle on who cooks the best jollof rice in West Africa continues with a Jollof War Festival in South Africa. We have those stories plus sports coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. UN aid agencies are warning of a looming humanitarian catastrophe in northern Ethiopia's Tigray region if they are prevented from delivering life-saving assistance to the area. The Ethiopian government's unilateral ceasefire in Tigray after 8 months of conflict has not got off to a good start. The UN Refugee Agency reports that electrical power and phone networks in its offices in the capital, Mekelle, are not functioning, hampering its ability to deliver humanitarian aid. Speaking at a briefing at the UN offices, Eric Aneko, the spokesperson for the Secretary General, said that the situation in Tigray remains volatile and unpredictable.
Our humanitarian colleagues say that the situation in Tigray remains volatile and unpredictable. Major towns, including Mekelle, Adigrat, Adwa, Aksum, and Shire remain calm, but there are unconfirmed reports of clashes in the southern and northwestern zones. Electricity and telecommunications are still cut off throughout the region. There are no flights or road transportation in or out of the region. Despite this, our humanitarian partners continue to operate in line with humanitarian principles. For example, yesterday, the UN Migration Agency delivered fuel to operate water pumps, as well as firewood for cooking in a few displacement sites in the Mekelle area, benefiting several thousand people.
The WHO reports that an estimated 3.5 million people are at risk of cholera. It says that 6 million people are vulnerable to malaria, especially malnourished children. Eric Aneko says that there is a sense of urgency to get additional staff and supplies into Tigray.
Partners are continuing to bring water into Shire and displacement sites in Mekelle. An international NGO partner continues to provide medical services in Samre town in the southeastern zone. We, along with our partners, are assessing access along main roads to several areas to resume aid delivery. Our colleagues say it is urgent to get additional staff and supplies into Tigray to restore electricity and telecommunications and ensure that cash and fuel are available throughout the region for the continuity of humanitarian operations.
Tanzanian opposition leaders and rights activists held a forum Thursday arguing the government to revise the constitution to allow more political space. The forum, called Katiba Day, which means Constitution Day, comes after President Samia Hassan asked Tanzanians to give her time to first fix the economy. Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam.
The movement was fueled by President Samia Hassan's remarks Monday when she held her first press conference. Hassan urged Tanzanians to give her more time before she can allow the banned political rallies to resume and revive the stalled process of drafting a new constitution. Give me some more time so that I can stabilize Tanzania economically, inviting investors to invest and creating jobs, and then the rest will follow, the president said. When the time arrives, we will deal with the issue of new constitution and lifting the ban on political rallies. She added that Right now, we do allow political parties to organize meetings with their people, and I think you see that. The late President John Magufuli halted the process of drafting a new constitution soon after taking office in 2015 and banned political rallies the following year. Opposition politicians say there's no reason to give President Hassan time, saying that democracy cannot limit economic growth. Benson Singo is the deputy secretary of the Party for Democracy and Progress, better known as Chadema.
Katiba inatakiwa iandikwe, sio kwa matakwa ya rais.
The constitution needs to be written not for the president's wishes, but for the wishes of Tanzanians, he says, adding that his party will not agree to give the president additional time, because even Magufuli requested more time to build the country. When we gave it to him, he dropped the economy, he said. Rights groups say the president should focus on the constitution since it facilitates stability. Onesmo Lengurumwa is the director of the Tanzania Human Rights Defenders Coalition. The things the president wants to do will go smoothly if she has a constitution that allows her to do them with the assurance of stability, he said, adding that she has to do things in the national interest, not in her own interests. Tanzania is currently governed by the 1977 constitution that was formed under a single-party system. Opposition and critics are challenging it since it favors the ruling CCM party. Charles Kombe for VOA News in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
The South African pharmaceutical company Aspen has begun production of 400 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine for African countries. To speed up the process, the company is getting a large funding boost from the U.S. government. For more on this, Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Speaking during a virtual press briefing Thursday, Mark Mashik, a top executive for the U.S. International Development Financial Corporation, said Aspen will receive about $712 million to produce vaccine for people in Africa.
Our consortium of development finance institutions will provide a direct loan to Aspen to, among other things, strengthen their balance sheet with long-term financing, support vaccine production, and expand their operations with core operations based in South Africa. Now, this loan will help them increase capacity to support Aspen's efforts to produce vaccines for the continent this year and next year.
Gail Smith, the U.S. State Department Coordinator for Global COVID-19 Response, says the investment will help Africa deal with long-term health issues.
We see this investment as, in the short term, a really valuable response to the urgent need on the continent for vaccines for COVID, but also, and importantly, as a long-term investment in the capacity of the continent to increase its own production of these vital goods, so that there's greater availability and resilience over time. So it's a short-term investment with a long-term vision.
The world needs at least 11 billion COVID-19 vaccine shots to at least help communities return to normal lives. So far, less than 2% of Africans have received a vaccine. The need for vaccine has prompted criminals to exploit Africa's weak regulatory systems to bring in phony and substandard drugs. In November, officers from South Africa's Custom and Crime Unit seized 2,400 fake COVID-19 vaccine doses. Zambian and Chinese nationals were arrested. In January of this year, Nigeria's Food and Drug Administration advised the public to be aware of phony vaccine in the market. Adebayo Elonge is the head of Raxol, an organization that fights counterfeit and substandard medicine in Africa using artificial intelligence technology. He says African governments need systems to efficiently distribute and keep track of the vaccine.
They can have selected sites across the country where people can go and be vaccinated, and people pre-book online or by SMS. And then government keeps a record of those people who have come and taken the vaccine at those locations.
Aspen, which is based in the city of Durban, is slated to produce 400 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Distribution will begin in the next few weeks. Mohammed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
This is Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Burundi and Rwanda have promised to normalize their relations after more than 6 years of tension between the two countries. The move comes as Rwanda's prime minister visits Burundi, the first for a Rwandan top official to travel to Burundi since 2015. Moses Havyarimana reports.
Rwanda's Prime Minister Edouard Ngirente was cheered by the crowd in Bujumbura when Burundi President Evariste Ndayishimiye called him to address the public during the celebration of 59th independence anniversary. Burundi President Evariste Ndayishimiye said that his visit brought joy and happiness between the citizens of the two countries. He says that he believes now it is time to open a new chapter and put on an end to the past. He says that he is calling upon Burundians to move with time so that they can adapt with the time. Otherwise, it may take time to reach towards the achievements. Rwanda's Prime Minister's presence in the celebration was one of the major talking points, as it was the first time a top official from Rwandan government visited Burundi in the last 6 years. The Prime Minister said that his country is looking forward to improve their relations with Burundi. He says that he would like to reiterate the engagement of Rwanda to work together with the Burundian president to reinforce strategic partnership. He says that he trusts that Burundi and Rwandan government are ready to consolidate the promotion of relations between the two countries. Fred Mukasambide is a lawmaker in the East African Legislative Assembly.
This one is indicative of the resolve by the government of Rwanda for the purpose of reinvigorating and restoration and renaissance of better relations and entente between the two republics. It follows the several meetings that have been held since 2020 between the two countries, one between the military and another between the ministers of foreign affairs at Nemba, one-stop border post. And I think that is applaudable. This is the way to go for the two republics, for the better performance of the objects for which the East African community was established.
The relation between Burundi and Rwanda deteriorated since 2015 when Burundi's former president Pierre Nkurunziza vied for another term in the office. Burundi accused Rwanda of playing a role in the 2015 failed coup, while Rwanda accused Burundi of sheltering the FDLR rebels who are accused by Kigali of committing the 1994 genocide. However, since Burundi's president took over the office in 2020, major steps have been taken towards normalizing relations with the neighboring Rwanda. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
In Zambia, the ruling Patriotic Front is accusing the main opposition United Party for National Development Alliance of violating a directive banning campaigning in parts of the country. In an official complaint to the Electoral Commission of Zambia, the governing party petitioned the electoral body to punish the UPND alliance for acting with impunity in defiance of the campaign ban. It cited the group's campaign in Mazambuka as the reason for the electoral body to swiftly act against the alliance. Tabo Kawana is a spokesperson for the UPND alliance. Reacting to the PF complaints, he tells VOA's Peter Cloti that it appears the ruling party wants to use state institutions to prevent the opposition party from competing in the upcoming August 12th presidential and parliamentary elections.
They have tried to use all state institutions, including the police and the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Local Government and the EZZ itself, that has banned rallies and all political meetings that congregate people in the name of COVID. And we have adhered. All the meetings that are taking place in Zambia and campaigns, as you can see clearly even on social media platforms, are being conducted by the PS themselves. We have noted and seen that they have written to the Electoral Commission of Zambia, and they have put an advert there claiming that we are promoting hate speech. That advert first appeared last year. It's a very bad advert showing genocide and all these things, and they claim it is from us when it is not from us. So we are not congregating people. We are not able to congregate people. Even when we try to have indoor meetings, we have police and patriotic front cadres coming into our private homes and disturbing our meetings and causing violence against us.
But Thabo, in a statement made available to the media, signed by the party general secretary David Nwela, the PF accused the UPND that on June 30th, the UPND alliance defied the directive of the Electoral Commission with what the party described as impunity by holding roadshows in Mazabuka.
There was no roadshow in Mazabuka. What had happened in Mazabuka is that our candidates had gone to ShopRite to go and buy supplies. And the people were cheering him. And they were very happy to see him. And as he went in his vehicle and was driving away, the people were cheering for him. And they went to ECZ and complained that that is a roadshow. It is not a roadshow, Peter. It is just that the people of Zambia have rejected the Patriotic Front and they are feeling the heat.
But are you therefore saying that the evidence the Patriotic Front has, for which it presented to the Electoral Commission of Zambia to take action against the UPND, is non-existent?
It's non-existent, and when the ECZ will investigate, they will see that it was not a roadshow being conducted. What they are trying to achieve is a situation or a scenario where the ECZ will ban the UPND from participating in the election. They are trying to find a loophole to try and get us not to participate in the election because they know that they are losing the election. All these antics in the name of evidence and so on are just kicks of a dying horse. They are out, and we are not abrogating any laws. We are not abrogating any rules. We are not abrogating anything even to do with the COVID-19 regulations. They are just in trouble, and now they are espousing what we will clearly term as kicks of a dying horse.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Now, one of the biggest battles in West Africa has nothing to do with actual war. It is a long-standing rivalry between Nigerian and Ghanaian styles of jollof, a staple of most West African homes. The debate, often driven by social media, especially among the West African diaspora, on which country cooks the most delicious medley of rice and a variety of spices, is battled out in cultural festivals organized in major international cities like New York and Atlanta. This past month, the first of its kind Jollof Festival was held in Johannesburg, South Africa. The organizer Adetunji Omotola, a cultural curator based in Sandton, tells me that the festival is less about the Jollof itself and more about people coming together to enjoy food and learn about each other's culture.
I'm actually a wine consultant, so I do a lot of fine dining. And one of my passions is to promote African food and African wine. And I've done quite a bit of that. So I thought this year, let's try and do something. So that's how we came up with the Jollof World South Africa. And incidentally, there were more South Africans that attended this event than the total number of Ghanaians and Nigerians. So the South Africans took ownership of it far more than the Ghanaians and Nigerians.
I mean, that would make sense since it's taking place in South Africa. But do you have a decent amount of Nigerians and Ghanaians in South Africa?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, the figures that are bandied around, if you Google, you find they say there are 24,000 Nigerians in South Africa. But, of course, some people say we're about 800,000. But obviously, there's no census. I think Ghanaians will probably be, you know, in the tens of thousands as well, but they're not as visible as Nigerians because Nigerians are very flashy. They like to show off a little bit.
They are very well represented as a population. So how did the competition go? Who was cooking? How did you select the chefs? Was it something that was open to the general public to come and cook? Or you had a select number of chefs you had pre-selected who are part of the community?
That's a good question. Basically, there are a lot more Nigerian restaurants, especially in the Sandton area. Sandton is like Manhattan. So you have a lot of Nigerians who have opened up restaurants. There's actually no Ghanaian restaurant in the Sandton area. There used to be one called Asanka, but it's no longer in operation. So it's quite difficult for me to find Ghanaian chefs. So what I did was I called the Ghanaian High Commission in Pretoria, and they linked me up to a Ghanaian. And then through my Facebook friends, I got a Ghanaian to introduce me to another lady that cooks as well. So there were two Ghanaian chefs. There's only one Nigerian chef. We opened it up to those that we know that they have a certain standard, those who have a restaurant, that we have an idea of what they do, because we didn't want to pick people randomly. And, you know, so we ended up with three chefs. In fact, there was a fourth chef, which was a celebrity chef, my son, 18-year-old son. So he can cook jollof, but he wasn't part of the prizes. But I thought because it was on Youth Day, which was a significant day in South Africa's history, if you remember, June 16, 1976, the Soweto Uprising. So I felt the element of bringing a youngster in, also for him to get a sense of how these things work. Mm. So there were four chefs in the end, but a Ghanaian won it and a Ghanaian came second, and the Nigerians were at the end.
That was Adetunji Omotola, a cultural curator, organizer of Jollof War in Johannesburg, South Africa. Now it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports, and for that we go to Abuja, Nigeria with Samson O'Malley. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, Jackson. We begin the sports at the Confederation of African Football headquarters in Cairo, Egypt, where CAF Deputy General Secretary Anthony Bafor has led the Continental Football Body. Bafor, who has been the Deputy General Secretary since 2007, has been in charge of football and development at CAF. Bafor said his decision to leave is purely personal. And to Rwanda, where members of the Rwanda Football Federation have backed businessman Olivier Nizeziyama to lead them in the next 4 years. Elections attracted dignitaries from both the World Football Governing Body, FIFA, and CAF, as well as SACAFA President Wallace Karira. Staying with football news, Nigeria Professional Football League will literally be on trial when a full complement of players drawn from the domestic league face off against the CONCACAF Gold Cup holders, Mexico, in an international friendly match on the 3rd of July 2021, pitched for the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum in the state of California, United States of America. The tie is part of the Mexicans' Mex Tour Series. The clash in Los Angeles will be the sixth confrontation between the senior teams of both countries, four of which have ended in draws, with the Mexicans claiming the only win 2-1 in the 1995 U.S. Gold Cup encounter in Dallas. Anayo Iwala is one of the locally based players who is on the roster of the Super Eagles.
Yeah, it's been nice. It's been fun. The players, everybody, we are all giving our best, because we know the task ahead. We know why we are here, and we know what we have to do to prove ourselves right. It's a great opportunity given to the home base, and being represented in Nature is a task ahead that we must fulfill. And we are all putting our heads together to make sure we fulfill that task.
And now to athletics. Caster Semenya failed in her latest attempt to achieve the Olympic qualifying time for the 5,000 meters, but she will not have been included in the South African team for the Tokyo Games, even if she had. The 30-year-old finished in fourth place with a time of 15 minutes, 50.12 seconds in Belgium. Meeting organizers said falling short of the 15 minutes, 10.00 qualifying mark. Athletics South Africa said Caster Semenya had missed the deadline for Olympic entries, which was on Tuesday, and they were told by governing body World Athletics no exceptions will be allowed. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a great weekend. And that's it for this Friday, July 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again Monday for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clody and Ricky Shryok, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend, Africa.